From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Democratic frontrunners are making a final pitch to Michigan voters. We'll speak today with Bernie Sanders about kitchen table issues like health care.
This system does not work. It really is. It's dysfunctional. Its only goal is to make huge profits for the drug companies and the insurance companies.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden responds in Grand Rapids, addressing voters in crisis.
They can't afford to wait for a revolution. They're looking for results in their families and for themselves today, immediately, not tomorrow.
We'll hear some coverage of this morning's event. In other news we're following, the city of Detroit will restore water to thousands of households, moved not by years of community activism, but by the threat of COVID-19.
What this really exposes is that without health equity, you can't make up for it in public health emergency response. You need the foundations from the beginning.
All that's coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the past few days, Vermont's Senator Bernie Sanders has toured Michigan, rallying supporters ahead of tomorrow's presidential primary. Yesterday, he stopped by Grand Rapids, where he picked up an endorsement from civil rights activist Jesse Jackson. He then appeared in Ann Arbor yesterday evening in front of thousands of supporters. Bernie Sanders got an introduction in Ann Arbor from his ally, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Let's listen to her warming up the crowd.
We must bring more people into this movement. We must shed the unnecessary clothes of cynicism and exclusion. And we must turn towards an embracing posture where all people are welcome into a people's movement of the United States of America to establish free health care, to establish Medicare for all, to fight for a living wage, to demand humanity at our border. That is what this movement is all about, Michigan. We have a choice to make.
And then AOC announced Bernie Sanders to the amped-up crowd that packed the University of Michigan Diag.
Ann Arbor, thank you! Whoa! I cannot believe how many people are here. Thanks all for coming out.
Before his speech yesterday, I sat down with Senator Sanders for a one-on-one interview. Take a listen. Senator Sanders, thank you for making time for us.
My pleasure.
I wanted to start with a question that has to do with Medicare for All, but maybe it also gets to something broader. Michigan has a great many union voters and maybe union retirees who look at their benefits and their health care plans, and they think about how hard fought those things were. Why should they take a gamble on a plan that is new and different and that might represent a level of benefits that's less than what they have?
Because it won't represent a level of benefits less than what they have. What we are talking about is comprehensive health care, which means you go to any doctor you want, same as you're doing now, any hospital that you want. But it also, under my bill, includes dental care, hearing aids, eyeglasses, and home health care. Very few union packages that are that broad and comprehensive. Second of all, if you talk to any local union leader, what he or she will tell you that half of their life is spent trying to defend the health care that they have. An employer will say, well, you want a 4% increase in wages? That's fine. We're going to raise your deductible. We're going to raise your premiums. We're going to raise your copayments. When you have Medicare for All and everybody in this country has solid, comprehensive, affordable health care, the unions can then go in and negotiate good contracts, good wages, good benefits, good pensions. Health care is now off the table. And if you talk to union leaders in Michigan or all over this country, they would say, my God, that would be extraordinary. We can focus on other issues rather than just health care. And the other thing that I would say is that as Americans, we have got to appreciate that we are the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a right. We're spending twice as much per capita on health care as do the people of Canada or most European countries. And yet, despite that, we have 87 million people uninsured or underinsured, 30,000 dying each year because they don't get to a doctor when they should, and 500,000 people going bankrupt because of medically related debt, not to mention that we pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. This system does not work. It really is. It's dysfunctional. Its only goal is to make huge profits for the drug companies and the insurance companies.
There's no question that Michiganders have economic need and will recognize that will be of benefit. There's so many people who don't have coverage or who have inadequate coverage. But to win a presidential election, you have to get people to come along who are maybe kind of comfortable in their situation. What do you have to say to them? Why? Okay. There are many policies that you've talked about that might represent a level of change that might be painful for some people.
I think that most of the issues that we talk about have significant support from the American people, not only Democrats, but Republicans and independents as well. Raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, does anyone still think that a $7.25 an hour federal minimum wage is anything but a starvation wage? We're right now here on the campus of the University of Michigan. It is my view that through a modest tax on Wall Street speculation, we could raise enough money to make public colleges like the University of Michigan, Michigan State, University of Vermont, tuition free, and that we can cancel all student debt in this country. The American people, as you recall 12 years ago, bailed out the crooks on Wall Street. They're making a fortune right now. They can afford to help us provide quality education to all people, regardless of their income. Climate change, well, we've introduced the most comprehensive climate change proposal ever introduced by a federal candidate. On this one, we cannot debate. All we're doing here is doing what the scientists are telling us we have to do, and that is, as quickly as possible, transform our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. So I think on all of those issues, this is what the American people want.
It's no secret that African American voters have been pivotal in Michigan's elections. And we also know that Joe Biden has done pretty well with African American voters historically. And on Super Tuesday, tell us about what you have to say about African-American voters. I mean, looking out just at the crowds here in Ann Arbor, also in Detroit and Flint, there's an awful lot of white faces out there.
Yeah, I think what this campaign is coming down to, and it's something very interesting, and I can't give you a definitive answer. We do phenomenally well with young people. I don't know the numbers, but we win just the overwhelming majority of young people, African-American young people, Latino young people, white young people, Asian American, Native American. We do very, very well. Truth is, and we're working on it, but I have to admit it, we're not doing well with older people, older African Americans, older whites, older Latinos. Okay, so you got an interesting generational split here. But I think the question is, if you look at the future of this country and you look at the future of the Democratic Party, which side would you rather be on? Would you rather be on the side of the future? These people, these young people, you know, people under 50, under 40, under 30, this is the future of America. And we should ask ourselves the question whether the future of the Democratic Party, whether we're comfortable with, you know, a candidate who is doing very well, I have to admit it, among people 65 and older. But you know what? The future of this, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is here. I just, you know, she'll be out in a minute. I just spoke with her. She is 30 years of age, all right? She is the future of the Democratic Party. Her vision, her ideas, her personality, not just her. So I am very proud that we're bringing in a whole lot of young people who are strongly supportive of us. Young people historically do not vote in the kinds of numbers that they should. And that's something we're working very, very hard on. Also, in this campaign, now that it has been reduced from 18 candidates to 2, we're going to have the opportunity to contrast our views with Joe Biden's. And I think it's important for people to know that our views are very different. Our records are very different. Joe and I have been around for a while, different records. Joe voted for the war in Iraq. I voted against the war in Iraq. Joe voted for disastrous trade agreements, which have impacted Michigan very negatively, PMTR with China, NAFTA. I voted against those agreements. Joe voted for the Wall Street bailout. I voted against the Wall Street bailout.
Joe, I'm sorry to interrupt. Joe Biden also voted for the auto industry bailout of 2008, and you did not.
No, that was the Wall Street bailout, okay? And you're absolutely right. Of course I support, and Congress supported, and the President supported a bailout for the auto industry, terribly important. That was tucked into the Wall Street bailout, and it was my view then, and it's my view now, that the working families of this country should not have had to bail out the banks whose illegal behavior and recklessness caused the crisis of the Great Recession. My view was, and I said this in meetings open and closed as a senator, that if they want to bail out, let them ask their billionaire friends to bail them out. It shouldn't be working people. And by the way, it's not just the TARP money that we're familiar with. They got trillions of dollars in zero interest loans, which is a direct subsidy.
Senator Sanders, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders spoke with us in Ann Arbor last night. In just a couple of minutes, we'll hear what his chief rival in this race, Joe Biden, is doing in Michigan today. Some voters are making some last-minute decisions about how to vote now that their first-choice candidate for the Democratic primary has dropped out. We talked with a few of them this week. Let's start with Kent Nichols from Grosse Pointe Woods.
My top-choice candidate in the Michigan primary was Elizabeth Warren. I'm torn now between Biden and Bernie. I see in Bernie someone who has a lot of great ideals and great ideas and a lot of amazing policies that Elizabeth Warren had as well, but lacks some of the pragmatism. And I look at Joe Biden and I see someone who's bringing large coalitions of minorities and people that are not like myself together and turning them out to the polls.
V. Prasad from Ann Arbor, Michigan, live in Detroit. I was planning on voting for Elizabeth Warren. So I did not vote early, so I still have my vote, and I'm going to vote for Senator Sanders. Well, I don't think he would be as effective a president as she would have been. I don't think he really has a plan for dealing with Mitch McConnell. But I do think he would be a really good foreign policy president.
Erin Gentry, and I'm from Battle Creek. Who was my top choice candidate? That would have definitely been Pete Buttigieg. The first time that I heard him speak, months before he even announced his candidacy, I was very interested and very excited to hear more. He has thrown his support behind Joe Biden, and Joe Biden was never my first, second, or even necessarily third choice. It feels a little bit slimy, but it seems like the safer vote just for me for what I'm thinking, you know, what I'm hoping is the outcome, which at the end of the day is that Trump is not in office.
Just a few of the voices of voters we talked to this week, Erin Gentry, V. Prasad, and Kent Nichols. Former Vice President Joe Biden brought his campaign to Michigan today on the heels of several appearances over the weekend from his main rival, Bernie Sanders. Here's Joe Biden talking with reporters.
Americans say they value decency, fairness, honesty, leaving nobody behind, giving everyone a shot in every community, everyone. And that's what this is about, American values.
Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman was at the Biden event this morning and joins us now. Hey, Bryce, how's it going?
It's going good. Thanks for inviting me on.
Where did the Biden campaign decide to stage their event this morning?
So they had it at Cherry Health, which is a nonprofit community health organization here in Grand Rapids, and they had it there because most of what Biden talked about was actually the Affordable Care Act and his plan for how to fix healthcare in America.
Is there any significance for him coming to Grand Rapids? Anything we can read into who would see him there or what the electorate on the western side of things might mean to the Biden campaign?
Well, he spoke to only reporters, so I'm not sure he was really thinking about the public of West Michigan as far as who he was going to speak to directly today. But he did talk about community health organizations, something that is kind of a big deal in West Michigan. So I think he was specifically tailoring his speech to appeal to voters who might be on the fence about, you know, who do they want to support, him or Bernie Sanders.
That's a contrast to Bernie Sanders' events over the weekend, I guess most noticeably the one in Ann Arbor last night, where a couple thousand people turned out to an open rally to hear Sanders speak. Well, what exactly did Joe Biden say about healthcare and what should happen in the future?
So Biden's plan is actually to fully restore the Affordable Care Act and restore everything that was cut from it, but adding a public option like Medicare for people who can't afford health insurance. In his health care plan, he put in contrast to Sanders' plan for Medicare for All, saying that, you know, the Affordable Care Act got passed, you know, it was working and people liked it. Bernie's plan is something that he says, you know, is still not everyone is sold on it, and it might have trouble getting passed through Congress. So, you know, Biden's whole strategy here is to say, hey, here's something that worked. Here's something that people bought into already. Let's restore it the way it was. Let's add a few things in to help people further along.
We say we value folks, and how can you, in fact, say you truly value folks and you really care about them when they don't have an access to basic fundamental health care all across America?
Was he very pointed in his critiques of Senator Sanders? Some people have characterized this as like a really huge showdown in terms of what the Michigan primary might tell us about whether both of these candidates can go forward.
So he definitely made a point to say that he thinks Bernie Sanders is a good person and is well-intentioned. But he pointed out, you know, just the nature of politics these days. If you want to get something through, you have to get bipartisan support. And Biden thinks he can do that better than Bernie can.
Bernie Sanders definitely brought friends along to his campaign events. He was endorsed by Jesse Jackson at one event over the weekend. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made an appearance at the Ann Arbor rally and just got huge applause lines. Did Biden bring any surrogates along or announce any new endorsements?
So over the weekend, he actually had Amy Klobuchar speak for him in Grand Rapids. But today, he was met with Governor Gretchen Whitmer. She's from West Michigan, so I assume that's why she wanted to show up. But they are both passionate about fixing health care. So he really wanted to make sure that he had someone who is a public figure here in Michigan and is someone who's very familiar with West Michigan to speak about the issue before he furthered it.
You know, if you go back to the strategic storylines of the 2016 campaign, there were some people who were pretty put out that Hillary Clinton did not spend a ton of time on the ground in Michigan in advance of elections. Was there any acknowledgement that Biden is just now visiting Michigan one day before the primary?
You know, he didn't acknowledge it, but I think every candidate in the race knows how important Michigan is going to be for this November election. So whether it be Biden or Sanders who gets the nomination, both of them, I think, will spend a lot of time here themselves in Michigan, not just with surrogates.
Bryce, thanks for the update.
Well, thanks for having me.
Michigan Radio's Bryce Huffman. You can read his story about the Biden campaign's visit to Grand Rapids on our website. We reached out to Joe Biden for an interview. The campaign declined to make him available. When you think about the census count that happens every decade, maybe the first thing that comes to mind for you is census workers knocking on doors and canvassing Michigan neighborhoods. But the U.S. Census Bureau is hoping that most people who live in the United States will use the internet to respond to the census this year, rather than filling out a paper form or talking to canvassers. And the online surveys begin this week. Anjana Susarla is an associate professor of information systems at Michigan State University. She's been studying the development of online canvassing in the era of big data. And she's written a recent article that might clue you into her perspective called Why a So-Called Digital Census is a Really Awful Idea. Anjana Susarla, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
How complicated is it to set up an online interface that potentially any American might use to answer the census? I mean, is an undertaking like this particularly difficult from an IT standpoint?
Well, definitely. You know, that was the reason I wrote this piece, to illustrate some of these challenges, especially from the perspective of cybersecurity. It's kind of almost scary how easy it would be for someone to manipulate a digital census. Because, you know, there are already a lot of attacks that happen online called distributed denial of attacks, etc. There are people who steal the Bitcoin wallets, people who build bots online. So there's also almost really an underground economy where people are sort of harvesting, you know, identities or sensitive and personal information. And there is almost a black market for this information online. So it's almost scary how many risks are out there. I think the United States, the census, the people administering understand these risks. But all the same, we are still very vulnerable in a way that a paper-based census is not.
What might a cyber attack look like when we're talking about the census's data?
One way could be by infecting devices with malware. So in other words, what is happening is, you know, when there is a form to be filled online, the form can be accessed from smartphones or, you know, your personal computers. All of these are probably don't have up-to-date security installed. So in other words, it's probably very easy for an attacker to, you know, find some vulnerable computers and infect it with the malware. Mm-hmm. And what that could do is it will tamper with the process of data collection. People will think they're filling information correctly, but when it goes to the census, someone can be tampering with that information.
Hardly a week seems to go by without some kind of big data breach. We tend to hear most reporting about this centered around retail operations or sometimes credit card companies or healthcare companies. I see the Department of Defense, though, got hit just late last month. It's kind of hard to get a grasp of the consequences of what could happen if the census were moved more online and if that data was hacked. What might some of the repercussions be if this were to happen?
Well, the repercussion is that, you know, somebody could think they're legitimately filling out the census form, but when they click to submit, there is some malware that is on their computer that can edit the respondent's data before it's transmitted to the census servers. So what does that mean? It means that we don't necessarily have an accurate count of everybody who lives in the United States as the census is supposed to do. And that could end up maybe skewing the resource allocation and proportional representation and things like that. And it, you know, it's also a possibility that malicious actors are trying to interfere with this process of what data gets reported to the census. So it's a frightening possibility that, you know, can happen.
If we consider this from the criminal perspective, as you say, there are two kinds of people who might be interested in interfering with census data. Mm-hmm. People who have a political motivation or social motivation, or people who want to try to exploit census data for economic reasons, you know, who just want to steal identity information online. Is there more data available through the census for criminals to exploit than is already out there on the servers of credit card companies or other entities?
Well, you know, that's been one of the counter opinions, that is, people already have enough sensitive data about us and so forth. So I think it still does not minimize the challenge of what, you know, we can get using census data. There could still be enough economic data, or there can be establishment level data. There can be things about the demographic information that we can get from a census form that we just don't always get through other kinds of online transactional data.
What comes to mind when you think about that?
I think, you know, one of the things I'm concerned about is also that the cybersecurity challenges that have been outlined is actually through the Government Accountability Office. Earlier, I think even 2 years ago, warned about some of the challenges relating to the cybersecurity weakness. And does the census have a system in place, some kind of fail-safe thing where, you know, if we have evidence that something is being tampered, do we have some contingency plans and so forth? I think to me, that's one of the areas that is an open question.
Is there anything that census officials can do to guard against online actors who are have malicious intention to census data?
I think, yes, it's, you know, it's fair to say that the Census Bureau understands some of these issues. But as I said, there's still enough gaps that remain. And that's why I highlighted this report made by the Government Accountability Office a while back, they said that this is a high-risk corporation trying to get all the data on collection online. And they made almost 112 recommendations to address all the concerns about testing, you know, securing all these partnerships, how does the data stored safely and so forth. But those are the things where maybe the Census Bureau needs to probably release more information to the public and tell us that they are actively addressing all these cybersecurity risks.
Do you think there could be problems if a great many Americans tried to access a census website or a census server at the same time?
Yes, I think that could be an issue, but I think the census probably understands it. You know, it's not I'm sure they have done extensive testing and what is called even scale testing for the scalability. So they probably understand that issue. But having said that, we don't know what will happen when it actually everything goes online.
Right. Are there ways, do you think, to, I mean, obviously it's cheaper for the Census Bureau to collect some of its data online, if not most of its data online, rather than sending human beings around to try to canvass every single house, as was the case in prior decades. Are there ways to address the cost issues or to leverage data in a way that could save the Census Bureau some money without the kind of online data surveying that the census is doing?
Well, definitely, you know, one of the things that census is, I think, tried to do very well is they tried to have a good understanding of which are the households that are comfortable using the internet and have high-speed broadband, etc. And they developed some kind of measure of, you know, which are the comparatively disadvantaged households, that is, those without access to broadband, internet access, and so forth. So, you know, they have, I think there's also all these public and private partnerships, like what is called the hard-to-count map, which tracks these households that have poor internet access. And you know, if there's racial disparities or income-based disparities with which, you know, people access broadband, internet, and so forth. So they've tried to adjust for the method of data collection where they can follow up with more paper-based forms in areas where people are less likely to use broadband internet. So I think they've developed a lot of methods to address kind of gaps in internet access or the digital divide, if you will.
Yeah. What else should be on people's minds when we think about potential risks of online census data?
Yeah, I think privacy is another major issue with the Census Bureau data. People are worried about, you know, the census, when they collect data of this magnitude, and they release at least some kind of aggregated data about individuals, there are a lot of concerns about how much privacy are we sort of giving up when census is collecting data about us. And the census has tried to address it also through what is called differential privacy, which is that they will try to de-anonymize the data using some special statistical methods. And it could be very interesting, again, the census being such a very large-scale data collection effort, it's supposed to count every single human being in the United States. So it would be interesting to see, again, how all these things will unfold.
Anjana Susarla is an associate professor of information systems at MSU. Anjana, thank you so much for talking with us about this.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan, the Great Lakes state, pure Michigan, is also the only state in the country without uniform septic tank regulations. Michigan lawmakers have been trying to come up with some septic legislation for decades, but they haven't been able to make all interest groups happy. The lack of a statewide law means a patchwork of county and local laws are keeping track of septic systems. Or not. One northern Michigan county nearly lost its inspection program. And some say that local realtors are to blame. Kay LaFond, science and conservation reporter for Interlochen Public Radio, and Sherry McWhirter, an environmental reporter for the Traverse City Record Eagle, worked on this report.
Bacteria from human waste is in Michigan's rivers. A lot of it comes from faulty septic systems, and there's no state law requiring that our 1.4 million existing septic systems are checked on as they get older. Instead, county and sometimes municipal governments are in charge of tracking and inspecting septic tanks. Less than a dozen of Michigan's 83 counties have a septic inspection program. Kalkaska County just tried to get rid of theirs, and some residents think they did it to please local realtors.
At the state level, realtors are just one of many powerful competing interests. And the Michigan legislature just can't write a septic bill that they all like. But more on that later. Our story starts on Manistee Lake, just northeast of the village of Kalkaska.
There's no law requiring Seth Phillips to pump or inspect the septic tank at his waterfront home. But he feels strongly about doing so.
We're still using it. Lake's right there. You know, we're groundwater here is pretty shallow.
Faulty or overfilled septic tanks can send bacteria or nutrients into the groundwater. Where Phillips lives, it would basically mean sending human waste into Manistee Lake. That can make people sick or cause algal blooms. And some homes on Manistee Lake are old.
There were people around here that had built, you know, old fishing cabins like a lot of places are, and they didn't really build a septic system. They buried a 55-gallon drum in the ground or just built a little block tank.
Phillips and other residents were concerned about sewage getting into the lake, so they helped get the county into a point-of-sale septic inspection program. That was in 2008. Since then, most home sales in Kalkaska County have required a septic inspection. Remember how we said Phillips doesn't legally need one? It's because he's not selling his property. That's a weakness in any point-of-sale inspection program. Homes that don't get sold don't get inspected.
Originally, we were pushing for a larger program to get all septic systems. There wasn't support for that, so we supported the point-of-sale program as a good first step, not as the end-all.
Kalkaska County's program also can't force somebody to repair or replace their septic tank, not unless there's standing sewage on the ground. But Phillips says the program is better than nothing. Homeowners get information, and they get their tank pumped, which is included in the cost of the inspections.
Phillips never thought that a decade later he'd have to work to save the same program. But the Kalkaska County Board of Commissioners voted against these septic inspection requirements twice in the last 2 years.
A lot of the folks opposing, who supported getting rid of this program, argued Kalkaska's program isn't effective, doesn't have enough teeth, too many exceptions, all that. I agree with all that. But to me, the argument isn't throw it away, let's fix it.
The county board says they'd rather let the townships deal with septic oversight. But according to Phillips, they were just doing what a handful of local real estate agents wanted.
Here's a recording of realtor Bob Murray speaking at a Kalkaska County Board of Commissioners meeting in November 2018.
I would hope that you guys would make this thing go away. It would be a huge benefit to everybody in the county and especially us realtors.
Murray and another realtor talked about the cost of inspections at that meeting, saying it was a burden on homeowners. They said it slows down real estate transactions. And they also brought up the program's holes, saying it wasn't actually protecting water quality. That evening, the Kalkaska Board voted to flush their septic inspection program. They share their health department with other counties, so they needed their approval to bail out. And they also had to hold a public hearing. Dozens of residents and environmental organizations wrote letters and showed up to give public comment. They wanted the county to keep the inspection program. But it didn't seem to matter. The commissioners went ahead with their plans and voted again to get rid of the regulations.
And at the end, they were still saying the same things they were saying at the beginning, which tells me none of what we said, none of the data we provided, none of the facts we gave them mattered to anybody.
After all of that, another downstream county in the shared health department voted not to allow Kalkaska County out of the inspection program. So they still have a point-of-sale septic requirement today. In trying to do away with it, Phillips thinks the board put the interests of realtors over what many constituents wanted. Kalkaska County Commissioner Craig Cramble says that accusation is an insult.
Realtors had no influence on what we did. What had the influence on it is they're just collecting money from people and slowing down people in the process of selling their real estate.
We called local realtor Bob Murray, and he said he and his peers have influenced the board.
I've had numerous discussions with some of the different county commissioners that have sat on those boards and went to and attended, I think, three or four meetings. So I think they've listened.
And he thinks they should listen. After all, he says, realtors are the ones dealing with people.
And these people are bloody mad about the whole circumstance because of the time and the cost and whether it's even really needed.
So that's the story of how Kalkaska County almost got rid of its septic inspection program. And it all happened partly because, again, Michigan is the only state that hasn't passed a uniform septic code.
It's not because lawmakers haven't tried. Representative Abdullah Hamoud is a Democrat from Dearborn. He co-sponsored septic legislation in the Michigan House in 2018.
There are a lot of powerful stakeholders who have a lot of interest in this legislation, such as the realtors, such as the farmers, the Farm Bureau, such as environmental groups, and everybody has a different vision for what the septic tank regulatory system should look like.
Hamoud worked with Jim Lauer, a Republican from Cedar Lake, who also mentions working with real estate lobbyists.
A lot of the industry groups, like, for example, the Michigan Association of Realtors, was supportive of that version of the bill and had worked with us on it.
They were supportive because the bill didn't link inspections to home sales.
The reason they fear these policies in a lot of cases is they don't want to be made into essentially a septic enforcement agent when that's really not their wheelhouse.
Instead, the bills called for septic system inspections every 10 years. That made the realtors happy. But for some, it was too much government oversight.
The introduced version was very, I guess you'd say, optimistic in terms of it really would have solved a lot of problems, but it went a lot further than most people were willing to go.
So, says Lauer, they pulled back. By the time the bill was passed out of committee, it was really watered down. It also banned county or local septic laws stricter than the proposed statewide code. Environmental groups saw that as a net loss. The bill died.
At this point, you're probably wondering, how did 49 other states handle this? We'll just tell you about one, Minnesota. In Minnesota, county or local governments administer their own septic programs. But they must have a septic program, and it must be as restrictive as state rules. Minnesota has something else Michigan doesn't.
So we have the Clean Water Legacy Fund. So that was developed through tax money, sales tax money, to work on water quality, arts, and other things in the state.
And that's Aaron Jensen of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. His state helps homeowners with the scariest part of septic inspections, possible repair costs. They could run into the thousands.
If homeowners are low income, they can apply for grant money and get money to fix their system. And we've made the requirements very minimal.
It's not clear when septic legislation will be introduced in Michigan again. Representative Abdullah Hamoud says this term, he's working on some basic things, like getting people to agree on what defines an inspection or a failed septic tank.
We're hoping that if we can't get the whole of a septic tank regulation through this term, then maybe we can at least start with definitions and criteria, and maybe a database.
He means a statewide database of septic systems. He admits it would be pretty incomplete at this point, but says Michigan has to start somewhere. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Kay LaFond.
And for the Traverse City Record Eagle, I'm Sherry McWhirter.
Today, city officials in Detroit announced a moratorium on water shutoffs to residents in light of the public health threat of COVID-19. Here's Mayor Mike Duggan making the announcement.
And the governor and I sat down and said, we're going to have a solution that no resident of the city of Detroit has their water shut off for lack of funds.
Water activists have argued for years that water shutoffs pose a threat to public health for a whole host of reasons and are more broadly inhumane. Nadia Gaber has a PhD in medical anthropology and is a medical student at the University of California, San Francisco. She's worked with We the People of Detroit, the leading group advocating against water shutoffs. Nadia Gaber, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can you give us some background on the conversation to date? I mean, haven't activists been trying for some time now to argue to the city that shutoffs are a public health issue?
Yes, absolutely. A coalition of groups, environmental justice groups, community advocates, have been arguing against the shutoffs from the beginning and calling for a moratorium, knowing that disconnecting people from water and sanitation is a huge public health risk and has real impacts on families. So it's a big win that I think what COVID has made clear is that the risk is very real. So it's a big step in the right direction, and we need to do more.
What has the counter argument been from city and some state officials?
Well, I haven't, to be honest, heard a convincing one. I think the financial argument has been disproven by a number of reports by an economist, Roger Colton, who's shown that actually if you have income-based affordability plans, more people are able to stay into the system paying what they can. So it actually increases the revenue stream that they would get, and it decreases costs of enforcing shutoffs and sending out all of these trucks that they've contracted to do so. There is a hang up around a possible interpretation of a legal provision that the city has argued makes it not possible for them to consider water affordability plans, but they do have sewer rating by income, and that's been argued by the ACLU, among other legal experts have also challenged that interpretation. So I think there are political dimensions to this that exceed what we know from both the economic and the health studies.
We should say that some reported stories that Bridge Magazine published recently suggested that there were key health officials at the state level and elsewhere sort of behind the scenes urging the city to stop shutoffs over health concerns, although not all of that debate has obviously been public. Do you think the city will ever be able to again justify turning off people's water?
I don't. And I hope that what this crisis makes clear is that there are real risks to leaving hundreds of thousands of people without basic access to water and sanitation. I mean, hand washing is the number one public health preventive measure, and that's very well established. And COVID is not the only infectious disease out there. So this is one of many health impacts, in addition to mental health impacts, social and economic impacts, and just the widespread indignity of turning off water to people who are too poor to pay.
What kinds of issues do come up in day-to-day public health that water plays a key role in?
There are numerous. So infectious disease spread, both bacterial and viral, is certainly one of them. So you have all of your seasonal flu viruses. You have bacterial illnesses that we have seen an uptick in since the water shutoffs began in Michigan with their epicenter in Detroit. So you had Shigella and other infectious diseases spread by not properly hand washing, not being able to clean the surfaces of your home, not being able to flush the toilet regularly, a reduction in showering or bathing, using bottled water to do some domestic tasks. All of those things, actually, we have some data on from residents who have reported having to decrease a lot of those just basic daily hygiene practices of cleaning and bathing and hand washing. So that's a major problem. We also have a study that talks about the real mental health impacts of having your water shut off. And we found that there was a significant increase in psychosocial distress, social conflict, feelings of depression, anxiety, worry, and financial health expenditure shifting among those who lost access to water and among people who believe that their water is not affordable.
Can you maybe give us some context for how the infectious disease problems associated with water shutoffs, you know, maybe how they stack up in a public health infrastructure? What is the difficulty of breaking through on issues surrounding diseases that might be related to water and water shutoffs?
I think it's almost challenging to pinpoint because it affects everything. You know, water is at the root, as I mentioned, of all of your sort of basic domestic hygiene practices, And it is something that we all need, that we all rely on, and that we share as a common resource in a public system. So because of that interconnectedness, it's long been known that it is the root of infectious disease control, as well as health maintenance and health equity. So I think in a way, it's because water touches on every aspect of health and social life, it almost makes it difficult to pinpoint or quantify why one specific change, what the impacts of that may be. Just as you mentioned, I mean, what we expect public health departments to do are maintain public health, decrease the risk of harmful exposures, including infectious diseases. But what we know is that the department itself and the infrastructure is not effective without policies that have health equity as their foundation. The CDC former director just wrote an op-ed saying what this really exposes is that without health equity, you can't make up for it in public health emergency response. You need the foundations of people being able to protect themselves and their families there from the beginning. And that's a long-term structural solution. And the foundation of that really is water and sanitation access.
What does it say that it took a global health incident, which has not even fully evolved in the United States yet, to get the city to acknowledge the public health risk?
I think it says we have a political system in gridlock. I think it says that we have built up so much structural neglect in our system, and we have almost implicitly accepted that people without the income or the resources to pay for basic access to life-sustaining services don't deserve them. And I think that that's why we have been so adamant from day one that this was absolutely unacceptable and a moral outrage in addition to a public health risk. And if it takes a new strain of an infectious disease to make us aware of the real risks that affect everyone when you shut off hundreds of thousands of people from water access, then, you know, crises crystallize what's kind of pre-existing in the social fabric. So I think that's just where we are. It is the right move to have a moratorium and immediately stop the shutoffs in light of this crisis, but that needs to be made permanent. And if we learn something from this, it is precisely that it shouldn't take a crisis.
What is this telling Detroiters about the value that's placed on public health?
I think Detroiters have unfortunately borne the brunt of all of the neglects in our system on many levels. And I think the water and sanitation crisis just crystallizes the extreme degree to which their lives are not valued. And I hope that they also see that they have people fighting for them, advocating for them, and that a number of groups have really pushed to put pressure on the city and the state in their interests. And hopefully there is enough public awareness through this crisis that the lives of each and every one of us are interconnected.
Nadia Gaber, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.